Sanghe chutang suki chonam la Jang chubar du na gi jab su chi Da gi jin so gi pi so nam gi Dro la pin chi sanghe du par shu. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, the Buddha's Dharma, the assembly of saints, the riches and merits that I collect by the practice of giving and other perfections, and I attain the state of the Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha's Dharma, the assembly of saints, and the riches and merits that I collect by the practice of giving and other perfections, and I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha room, may all sentient beings partake of the beauty of your life. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwar Radna Mandala Pudzame Samudra Saparanati. Okay, welcome to the beautiful ornament of the three visions. So, once again, thank you to Lama for bringing this wonderful text to us from Tibet via India, and we are all very fortunate to be here studying this text. So just to make a quick review of where we've arrived. So Sakyapandita made it easier for us by dividing this into two sections. So what are our two sections here? Preliminaries and the actual practice. Yeah. Okay. So we've finished the preliminaries. So congratulations to all of you for making it through the preliminaries. And what are, just to review, what are the two preliminaries? Faith and you said it. Faith and refuge. Okay. Just to review refuge a little bit before we go on. Is there only one way to do refuge? No. How many ways are there? Lots. And what does it depend on? Why are there lots of different ways?
Many students?
Yeah, many students, many traditions. Lots of traditions, so they're all good. And do you remember we talked about it's possible to combine refuge with another practice and do two practices at once? Does anybody remember talking about that? The heat's got everybody's brain melted, I think.
Bodhicitta?
We do it with bodhicitta motivation, but the actual practice that we can combine it with commonly is... Prostrations. So there's a lot of different ways to do refuge. Do you think there's only one way to do prostrations?
Probably not.
No. There's a lot of different ways to do prostrations. So we're not going to go through all of them, but I thought some of you know how to do prostrations. Some of you maybe don't. So I thought it'd be a good idea to just very quickly show a very simple way we can combine these two practices. And then everybody will have the practice, because we've been talking about it's not enough to just read the book, you have to do the practice, right? So, Steve, would you like to be our model?
Yes.
Could you just stand up here and I'll talk you through it. We'll just show people.
My body is very still.
That's perfect, because
okay.
We're going to do a real easy version of it. Okay, so if you could just imagine just that you just came in the door and you're over there.
Mm-hmm.
This also has to do with temple etiquette, you know, just common courtesy in temples and Dharma centers, so that you know. So before Steve sits down or gets water or do anything else, he's going to do prostration. So I'll just talk you through it. And what kind of prostration in our tradition in this book, what kind do we do? I mean, what kind of refuge do we do? I'm sorry, what kind of refuge do we do?
Three jewels?
Yeah.
Oh. Four noble
truths. Four opponent powers. Four opponent powers.
No. So for your homework, look it up, and next week tell me what kind of, what's the name? The fourfold. So there's different ways of doing it, and this one is the fourfold method, okay? So Steve comes in, and we've talked about visualizing the refuge tree or visualizing the single Buddha and all that. Some people, like me, I couldn't visualize. It was kind of rough. But here, we don't have to visualize anything because you have this wonderful altar with all the statues and the Buddhas right here. And there's also Dharma texts. There's pechas. And so we've got everything already set up for us. So Steve comes in, and he immediately goes, I go for refuge to the
Buddha?
Guru.
Guru. Sorry.
On top of your head.
Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
Crown. And then I go for refuge to the
Buddha.
So Guru, Buddha. Go for refuge to the
Dharma.
Go for refuge to the Sangha, okay, or assembly. And then we do that three times. So I go for refuge to the Guru. Go for refuge to the Buddha. Go for refuge to the Dharma. Go for refuge to the Sangha. And then one more time. And he's thinking this while he's doing the motions, the movements. Yeah. And then a little bow would be nice. And that's a real simple way. Now you've done two practices at once, right? Thank you. 5 points for Steve. So why do we bother with all this body stuff? Why don't we just stand there and think it? It's supposed to be a mind practice, isn't it?
Respect,
yeah. What else?
It's to set your intention.
Sorry?
Set your intention.
That's with your mind, though, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
So why do we need to use our body? It's a lot of work. Huh?
For merit?
Yeah, for merit, for physical practice. Body, speech, and mind, right? So you create that kind of merit with your body. So there's lots of practices that use your body. There's walking, circumambulation, offerings. So we use our body. If we have a mala, we use our body, right? So we've got a chance when we come in to right off the bat collect a whole bunch of merit just before we even sit down. And it's, as I said, it's also temple etiquette. Okay? Yeah? Good job. And then there's another thing for temple etiquette, which is, would you like to give Steve a cushion?
Sure.
That we always have a cushion in case we need to put our books somewhere. We don't put them on the floor or put them on our knee or put them somewhere.
Yeah.
So that's another, it's just courtesy, you know, respect. So that's another thing for temple etiquette. So that's a little lesson in practice that you can do when you come in. Okay? Any comments about that? Or questions? We're on to the main teaching, which I believe in our book is page 19. And I hope it's the same in that book. Is it the same? It is? Yeah, okay, so page 19, the main teaching. So that I don't burn out my voice, would somebody like to help me reading tonight and volunteer for this first paragraph here?
I can.
Okay.
Do you want under the main teaching or the next page?
The main teaching.
To practice meditation upon the main teaching, there are three parts. One, the instructions on the impure vision in order to produce renunciation. Two, the instructions on the vision of experience in order to produce noble aspirations. And three, the instructions on the pure vision in order to produce enthusiasm.
Okay, thank you. So that's a short paragraph. In fact, it's only one sentence, but there's quite a bit in this. So let's go through and see what we have here. To practice meditation upon the main teaching. Does that remind you of anything that I've been repeating since the first evening, Aaron?
The whole
Which is?
Which is contemplation and meditation.
What's first?
Analyzing,
is that? Listening.
Before analyzing, I want to
listen.
And then I want to
analyze.
And then I want to
meditate.
And so what is...
I guess I separated it into this is listening and then acting.
Oh, okay, okay.
I contemplate and meditate.
Okay, okay, okay. Okay, so right off the bat it says to practice meditation upon the main teaching. So this is telling you how to do it and what the subjects are that you're going to analyze. And there's three of them. So the first one is the instructions on the impure vision in order to produce renunciation. Okay, so we have the three visions. We know that because that's the title on the cover. And the first one is the impure vision that ordinary beings have. And so the instructions about that, why do we do that? To produce renunciation. So what does that mean? What are we renouncing?
Samsara.
Samsara, cyclic existence, yeah. So we our idea in this first section is we want to produce this renunciation. Remember, we're building this tall skyscraper. We finished the foundation, the preliminaries, and now we're on building the first floor. And renunciation is that first floor. That's what's going to propel us in our practice is renunciation, and we're going to go into great detail about what is renunciation and how do you do it. So stay tuned for that. And then the second one is the instructions on the vision of experience, which is the second vision, in order to produce noble aspirations. Do you remember we talked about aspirations before? What did we say about aspirations? Anybody remember that?
Were they like in prayer, like in little prayers, and there were aspirations like you're wishing for this to happen?
It's a kind of prayer. We said there's different kinds of prayer. There's supplication and so on, and there's aspiration prayer. But we made a distinction between wishing and aspiration. Remember that?
Requires action, aspiration?
Yeah. Wishing is kind of wishful thinking. Gee, I wish I'd win the lottery, but I didn't buy a ticket, so I guess I won't. Whereas aspiration is more, I'm going to do this, you know? I'm going to drive to Toronto, I'm going to get a GPS, and I'm going to get the map, and I'm going to go. I'm actually determining that, yeah, I'm going to do this. That's an aspiration. Of course, you have to act, finish, you know, with the action. But the aspiration is planting the seed. It's like you're planting the karmic seed. It's stronger than wishful thinking, like, well, maybe, maybe not. This is like, no, definitely, definitely. I'm aspiring to something, in this case, complete enlightenment. And I'm going to do it. Why? Because all my mother sentient beings are suffering, and I can't stand that. That's our motivation, right? So this aspiration has a kind of, it has some oomph behind it.
Like breath, which takes a work, right? Like aspire.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So that's the second part. And then the third part is the instructions on the pure vision in order to produce enthusiasm. So what do you think that means?
Joyful effort.
Yeah. Who has the pure vision?
The guru?
Yeah, the Buddha, the guru. Yeah, the Buddha. So we want to go there. We want to have complete enlightenment. We want to become Buddhas, right? We aspire to that, and then we want to go and do it. It takes some work. It doesn't just happen, you know. Mm-hmm. So we need to have some enthusiasm.
More like direction.
Mm-hmm.
Really, like,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And Lama Jampa, when he gave his commentary, he defined this enthusiasm as being completely interested in the Dharma. Okay, so this isn't something that's going to just maybe happen, maybe not. If I have time, I'll get enlightened. You know, it's something that takes some focus, some direction, and some work. Let's be honest, it takes some effort. So joyous enthusiasm sounds nicer than work and effort. So this is it's sort of a preamble of what we're going to do for the next 200 pages in the rest of this text. So the main teaching has these three parts to it. You could also call it the fundamental teaching if you want to. Okay? So all of that is in that little paragraph. And so now we're going to start with the impure vision. So who would like to read that first paragraph there? Instructions on the impure vision to produce renunciation. Remember, we're doing this to produce renunciation. That's the whole idea here. Who'd like to read that?
I'll read it.
Okay.
These consist of A, the instructions on the faults of worldly existence in order to produce renunciation. B, the instructions on the difficulty of obtaining the prerequisites in order to evoke diligence. And C, the instructions on virtuous and non-virtuous deeds, their results, in order to show what is being accepted and what is to be rejected.
Instruction on the faults of worldly existence. When we say worldly existence, what are we referring to?
Samsara.
Okay, but what is that? What is samsara? Sorry?
Endless cycling through birth and death.
Yeah, it's this endless, meaningless circle that goes round and round and round and round, and it's full of suffering. And we don't want that. We want to get out of that. The Buddha got out of it, and he has shown us the way. And so it's renunciation that's going to give us the oomph to make the effort to get out of that cycle. Okay, and we're going to learn about renunciation. Something that, this is just my opinion, but I think it's not automatic because we don't really understand how much we're suffering. A lot of things that we think are not suffering really are. So we're going to learn about that. And then B, the instructions on the difficulty of obtaining the prerequisites in order to evoke diligence. What do you think that means?
Being born as a human.
Okay, being born as a human, that's a good start, but is that enough? No. You're right, that's where we want to be, but is that
to be exposed to the Dharma.
Okay, be exposed to the Dharma. So that's two. How many are on this list?
You're the teacher.
18. There's 18 boxes to check. Yeah.
Extreme.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why we call it. What's the name that we sort of give for this special opportunity we have as humans? Precious
human life.
Precious human rebirth. That's what it's usually referred to as, precious human rebirth. Being human is only one of the boxes. There's another 17 that have to be checked to have what we would call precious human rebirth. Yeah? So there's lots of people alive today even that have never heard it, even the name Buddha.
That's true.
They don't qualify. They don't have what we call precious human rebirth. It's really, really actually quite rare. If you go down the list of all 18, it's pretty rare. And that's why it's so precious. And that's why we have this incredible opportunity. Not only do we have the vehicle, the precious human rebirth, but we have this amazing text. And to have all of that and to be here in this room. By the way, these statues are blessed. Some of them are very old. Many of them are filled with mantras and precious relics and things. And you have the Pecha books here. So when you're doing your prostration here, there's a huge amount of merit in doing that. It's practically immeasurable, really. So we have this incredible opportunity. We have this precious human rebirth. We have this wonderful text. We have this wonderful space and this opportunity to study and understand it. And then you get to go home and
meditate.
Do your homework and practice. Otherwise, you just wasted a big opportunity, right? So it's really, I know I keep saying this, but it is really, really very, very special what we're doing here. And to even even be here. And then the third one is instructions on virtuous and non-virtuous deeds and their results in order to show what is to be accepted and what is to be rejected. So we're going to go through these virtuous and non-virtuous deeds. Now, some of them are obvious, like don't lie, steal, kill, that kind of things. But some of them aren't necessarily obvious, so we're going to go through that topic. So these are the three instructions on the impure vision to produce renunciation. So fasten your seat belts, here we go. So the first one, instruction on the faults of worldly existence to produce renunciation. Who would like to read that paragraph?
I can do something.
Okay.
It is said in the root treatise of Vajra verses of that I'm not going to be able to.
Virupa. Forget the title, just the Virupa.
Virupa. For sentient beings with the afflictions is the impure vision. This means that if one examines the nature of sentient beings, one will know that all sentient beings are not free from suffering. Therefore, those who strive for liberation, which is a complete liberation from worldly existence, must put an end to their attachment to worldly existence. To relinquish that attachment, one needs to recall the faults of worldly existence. And for that, one should rely upon the preceptor's instructions in order to know that the nature of worldly existence is entirely suffering.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so there's four points in this paragraph. Let's see if we can point them out. So first of all, it says, in the root treatise of the Vajra verses of Virupa. So who was Virupa? Where did all this come from? Where did Lamdre come from?
Buddha?
It did. Buddha? It did come from Buddha. There was the female Buddha who gave it to Virupa. Was a Buddha. Virupa was the human, though, that he's the first human in the lineage. So Virupa is the preceptor, what we would say would be the preceptor, okay? And do you remember we said in the beginning there was almost nothing written down? It was all oral. It was transmitted orally from master to student and so on, remember? But Virupa did write a very short text called The Root Treatise of the Vajra Verses. So that title is the title of the text that he wrote. It's often just referred to as the Vajra Verses. But that was the original written pecha that that started the lineage. And it was only later on that books and commentaries were written. In his text, in Virupa's text, he makes these points. And so he says, for sentient beings with the afflictions is the impure vision. So what does that mean?
Would be one with the ignorance.
Yeah. So all the negativities, the afflictions, the emotional afflictions, all these negativities that we have cause us to have what kind of vision?
Impure.
So the delusions.
The delusions, the afflictions, the negativities. That's why we suffer. We don't understand really the true nature of things. And as a result, we have the impure vision. So that's the first of our three visions, is the impure vision. What does that mean? Well, the first point is, this means that if one examines the nature of sentient beings, one will know that all sentient beings are not free from suffering. All we have to do is look at our own life. We suffer. Everybody does. Everybody's been sick. Everybody's going to die. And if we look around at other people, what do we see?
The same thing.
Same thing. And if you look at animals, do animals suffer? And so on. So if we really look, and you don't have to look very far to see that the nature of sentient beings is we're not free from suffering. So that it seems obvious, but we skip over that. We overlook that. So that's the first point. And then the second point, therefore, those who strive for liberation, which is a complete liberation from worldly existence, must put an end to their attachment to worldly existence. So we already said worldly existence is what? Samsara, round and around and around. And why do we go round and around and around according to this second point? What does this second point say?
Because we're attached.
Attachment. We're attached. We have attachment. We have grasping. Yeah. And so, if we want to have liberation, if we want to strive for liberation, which is liberation from worldly existence, if we want to get out of this vicious circle, and it is vicious, we have to put an end to our attachment to worldly existence. This is something that normally we wouldn't think about too much. We just live our lives, and we don't necessarily identify our attachments. And that's what we need to do. And that's why we need some help, you know. And so we need to eliminate that attachment. All the things that are keeping us attached to this worldly existence, that's what we have to focus on. We have to eliminate it.
But it's also understanding the definition of attachment in those terms, which is different from the way most people think of it.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the second point. And then the third point, to relinquish that attachment, one needs to recall the faults of worldly existence. So we're going to examine that in great detail, that worldly existence is full of faults, and so we need to recall the faults. This idea of listening, contemplating, and meditating, you could take any one of these points as your subject matter and do that process of listening, contemplating, and meditating. In fact, we really need to do that. We want to go take it in deeper and not leave it just superficial. Otherwise, it'll just be, oh yeah, I got that. Okay, what's for dinner? It doesn't really go in unless we do the third step. Okay, so we need to recall the faults. And for that, number four is we need to rely on the preceptor's instructions in order to know that the nature of worldly existence is entirely suffering. And this is where I think Buddhism takes a step forward, just to say that it's entirely suffering. Because our culture doesn't say that. Does it?
No, it does not.
It says, oh, everything will work out, don't worry. Right? You ever heard that?
Yeah.
What else does our culture say that contradicts this?
That you can find happiness and joy in objects, or in moments, or in people, and so on.
Yeah.
Outside things.
Yeah.
Outside us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do we believe that as a culture?
Yes.
Pretty much. Pretty much, right?
Yes.
So Buddhism says, The Buddha said, it's all suffering, and it's not going to work out on its own. And I've heard a lot of people fight against that idea and say, no, you Buddhists, all you talk about is suffering. You know, flowers are beautiful and babies are beautiful and life is beautiful.
Nobody's arguing that. That's not the point.
So we need to clarify that. And what is the step that clarifies it? Is it listening? Or is it?
Argumentative?
Analyzing.
Analyzing. Contemplating. We need to learn what is the teaching and what is not the teaching, right? So that second step is going to apply to this one.
Analyzing is just arguing with yourself anyway.
Right? That's
I'm sorry, what?
No. I said analyzing is just arguing with yourself anyway.
And what is arguing?
Well, it's opposing ideas, coming to a conclusion.
Persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
That's not analysis. Analysis is different.
Arguing is persuading.
I think.
See, persuading yourself.
Yeah, well, you kind of have to, don't you? Like,
yeah.
But analysis is understanding, gaining a deeper understanding.
Yeah. Maybe I see the persuasion as the first step in analysis.
Yeah. You have to.
Yeah.
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 I agree with you.
Has anybody been doing this three steps at home? I'm curious.
I know.
You have? How's it going?
Well, I want to say well, but not enlightened yet, so we're on the way.
Oh, I've been doing it, but I haven't been doing it according to you.
But do you find that going through those steps gives you some clarity at the end?
I do. I find that it helps me really remember when I sit down and
okay.
think about it. The problem is I don't often catch all of it. Sometimes I set out what I want to contemplate on, and I do a great job of that, at least I think. And then you'll ask questions, and I'll think, oh, that, I didn't think to... So,
yeah.
I think it's going
but on. It helps you remember, you said.
Oh, for sure.
So your cup is solid and functioning well.
Yeah, I'm just not always getting everything into it.
Yeah, no, that's okay. But you're doing the process. Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. Good. Okay, so we're getting forewarned that we're going to go through these steps here. Okay. So we need to rely on the preceptor's instructions to know the nature of world existence is entirely suffering. And then as Jetsun Rinpoche, Dakpa Gyaltsen, who was he? Anybody remember? He's on that tanka. He's one of the five Sakya founders, yeah. And he's the one that made it simple for us and divided it only two parts. Yeah. So he's my hero. He was a very interesting historical character. He was a lay person, and he was a vegetarian in Tibet in the 1100s and the 1200s, which was probably not easy. And he taught in his songs. Did he write songs? Tibet's top 40? Huh?
Are they chants more than a song?
Yeah, what are these? What kind of songs do you think he wrote? Karen knows. What? Tell us.
I'm thinking of actually Milarepa who did.
Same. He wrote songs too, didn't he?
Yeah.
Same kind. But what are these songs that these guys wrote?
They were the songs of realization that they had experienced themselves.
Yeah. Exactly. So these great masters, I shouldn't have said guys. I apologize for that. These great masters. They have these great realizations, and they just have these inspirations, and it's just spontaneous. It's not like they sat down, you know. They're spontaneous expressions of their realizations, and they're called doha, I think, right? Doha? Or songs of realization is what they are. So this is an example of another type of teaching in song form. Now, this is interesting because if you notice there's three lines here, and if you've been noticing as we go through these quotations, they're generally four lines. There's a kind of meter to them, I think. But there's a line missing here, and Lama Jampa pointed that out and said that they actually made a mistake when they printed this. There's a line missing. So if you want to take a pen and write the line that's missing in your book, it's the first line which says, to accomplish salvation.
So where does that go?
You see this poem at the end of page 20?
I think
it's the first. There's three lines, but there's a line missing.
And what is it?
To accomplish salvation, try to abandon attachment to the three worlds. To relinquish attachment to the three worlds, try to recall the faults of worldly existence. So that's the complete... There's more to the song, but that's the... It's been taken out here. And this is, remember, we're getting scriptural references constantly through this text to just show that it's based not just on the author's ideas, but there is basis for it. So that's the basis for it. So it's repeating what he said in the text. We need to recall the faults of worldly existence. And then... On the next page it goes on and it says, as it was said in a sutra, what are sutras?
The words
of
the Buddha.
Sorry?
The words of the Buddha.
Words of the Buddha, yeah. The world of desire is with faults. The world of form is with faults. Likewise, the formless world is with faults. And it is only nirvana that can be seen to be faultless. these worlds, the desire world, the form world, and the formless world, are three, what are called three realms. These are three places where beings are reborn and exist. We live in the desire realm. And then there are two other realms, the form realm and the formless realm. The form realm and the formless realms are places where people take rebirth when they do very advanced meditations, but they don't do them exactly correctly. And they sort of get off the path a little bit. In the form realm, the beings are reborn with bodies and they wear clothes. In the formless realm, they don't have bodies. They're just in these meditative states, these deep meditative states, but they're not out of samsara. They just sort of took a detour.
That's so weird.
Yeah. And that's not where you want to be.
So we're not in the form world?
We're in the desire realm.
Oh, can I say something? In the section where it says, it is only nirvana that can be seen to be faultless. The fact that you can see means like form. So you're kind of still within, but I'm assuming it's a different type of seeing, not one with form.
Sorry?
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, seeing,
not
realizing.
Okay, really.
Yeah.
Witnessing.
Yeah. This is so you are clear that you don't want to go off in one of these other two realms, form and formless, because they might look really good just from a distance, but they're not. It's still samsara. It's a way of classifying existence, okay? The three realms. And you'll hear this said, the three realms. But you'll also hear the five realms, and you'll also hear the six realms. Like many things in Buddhism, there's different ways of looking at things and different ways of classifying things. So in the next paragraph, Maitreya Natha, which is just another name for Maitreya, our friend Maitreya, the coming Buddha, we talked about Maitreya, taught, the five realms of existence lack happiness, just as there is no fragrance in a dirty object. Their sufferings are constant, like the suffering produced by the touch of fire, weapons, salt on wounds, and the like. Again, there's different ways of classifying things. So the five realms are classified here. This is Abhidharma tradition. But you'll also hear the six realms. So let's do the six realms, and then we'll talk about the five realms. So does anybody want to take a stab at what the six realms are?
Hell beings.
The hungry ghosts.
The animals. The people.
Human.
The jealous gods.
Jealous gods.
And the gods.
Gods. Okay, good. Jealous gods are sometimes called demigods, sometimes called asuras. You might see that written. So that's a classification of the six realms. Okay. And you'll often hear the three lower realms and the three upper realms. So get used to that if you haven't heard it before. Here it talks about the five realms, which simply combines the demigods and the gods into one. These are not enlightened gods, by the way. These are still samsaric beings who have gone into different rebirths because of different karmas. But as it says, it's still suffering, it's still samsara, and that's not the best place to be. Where is the best place to be?
Nowhere?
It's hard to get there without going through the human
realm. We just talked about this. Where's the best place to be?
Nirvana.
No, but in before we get there. To practice.
Precious
human rebirth. So human realm.
Wait a second. Does that mean that it is human realm specifically? Because could you be... I guess you do have to be human. Is that right?
I don't
know the 18 boxes to check.
We're going to get to the 18 boxes. That's B. We have A, B, C that we're doing. And precious human rebirth is going to be B. That's coming after renunciation.
So that means that, like, animals or hunger ghosts and all these other things don't actually get the opportunity to become enlightened? You literally have to be a human to become enlightened?
It's very, very difficult for them.
I
guess theoretically it's not impossible, but it's much, 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 much more advantageous to be a human with all the 18 boxes checked. For one thing, we have enough suffering to kind of kick us going into renunciation and practicing, but we don't have overwhelming suffering like a hell being is just overwhelmed with suffering. They can't even
see it. Get out of it.
They don't have a chance to practice at all. The gods are in this sort of godly realm where everything is cool and everything is given to them and they think they've got it made. They might even think they're enlightened, but they're not.
Wow.
Because it's not permanent. What happens to their karma eventually?
Runs out.
And then what happens?
They fall back.
They fall down.
All the way down?
It depends on their karma, where. So even though that looks good on the outside looking in, they have free food, cosmic sex, good music, big party scene. Eventually it ends, and they fall down. And the suffering of falling down is said to be very tremendous. The animals, they're not really able to sit and meditate and practice. And
Well, humans can cognize, animals can't.
Yeah, so the human realm with all the 18 prerequisites is the best place to be. We have a little bit of suffering, not too much. We have a lot of opportunity. And that's why this is so precious. And it's very rare, too. It's very rare. It looks like there's a lot of people, but not all the people have the 18 qualities.
There are trillions of sentient beings.
I don't know. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, yes. Thank you.
So anyway, you have these different realms, depending on how you want to divide things and look at things and where you can be reborn, but it's all suffering. It's all samsara. And we need to realize that and make sure that we take advantage of this opportunity and not aim for something like, gee, I wish I would be a St. Bernard, because they seem to have it pretty good. I've heard people say that. Dog's life, looks pretty good. Okay. I think I need to ask somebody else to read the next one. Who could volunteer for us?
Of it. One might well ask, what sorts of suffering, what kinds of unsatisfactoriness and faults are found in worldly existence? It is taught in the Dzogchenpanyi.
Okay, that's the Close Mindfulness Sutra. It's the English translation of that title, which probably none of us can pronounce.
That hell beings are tormented by the fires of hell. Hungry ghosts are afflicted by hunger and thirst. Animals by devouring each other. Humans are afflicted by short spans of life. And gods are undone by carelessness. There is never happiness on the nadir point of worldly existence.
Okay, so this is a very brief list of some of the different kinds of sufferings that happen in these different realms. It's certainly not a complete list. There's lots of other kinds of suffering that happen in these realms. For example, humans have lots of suffering, and it isn't just short lifespans. Everybody gets sick, and everybody dies. But it makes the point that there is no happiness in worldly existence. And again, when it says worldly existence, it means this samsaric circle of endless, meaningless rebirth. We really need to get this, that there isn't any happiness here, even though we think there is.
Well, it's lasting happiness.
Yeah,
right?
That's why it's
There's
not.
Short-term happiness, but it doesn't last.
Yeah, but according to the happiness, according to this, even that is a licking honey off of a razor's edge. It's an illusion that it's happening. Do you want to keep reading, because that was kind of short?
To reflect upon the sufferings of these states of worldly existence, it is taught that one should, 1, evoke sadness through reflection on the suffering of suffering, 2, reject attachments through reflection on the suffering of change, and 3, meditate longingly for liberation through reflection on the suffering of conditioned existence.
Okay. These are something that we referred to before, which are the three types of suffering. Which, do you remember we talked about Buddha's first teaching? What was Buddha's first teaching?
The Four Noble Truths.
Okay, Four Noble Truths. And what's the first noble truth?
There's suffering.
The truth of suffering, yeah. So this is going into more detail about that, listing the three types of suffering. And then the first one says, evoke sadness through reflection on the suffering of suffering. So first of all, what is the suffering of suffering? What do we normally mean when we say that?
It's more overt suffering, like pain.
Yeah.
Right, the obvious.
Yeah, you stub your toe and it really, really hurts. You have a headache. You got the flu. Okay. Now, why would we want to evoke sadness, though? I thought Buddhism was about getting happy. Should we ask for our money back?
Well, you're not going to look at it and be happy when you see it. Of course, you're going to be sad that this happens, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And why, though? Why do we want to feel sad? You look at it and it's sad, but why do you want to evoke it?
Compassionate sadness, sorry.
Uh-huh.
Compassionate sadness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it too?
Well, because you want to change it.
Yeah, and how?
Renunciate.
Renunciation. Yeah. Renunciation. To develop, that's the whole point of this first section, is to stimulate and develop renunciation. So if you really listen, analyze, and meditate on the suffering of suffering, it's sad. I remember Dorje Chang Dakshin Rinpoche gave a teaching about how it was really important to cultivate sadness, which on the surface sounds kind of odd, doesn't it? Unless you know that the reason is to develop renunciation and get us out of this thing that we've been sucked into, which is samsaric.
I feel like we're kind of inherently designed to do that to some extent, and I think that's why like a lot of South Americans have like telenovelas. It's like we're kind of constantly creating stories with regards to suffering and how everybody suffers, and it's like we don't really have a purpose, but like giving it a purpose for renunciation seems more productive than just creating suffering for the suffering of suffering. Like, does that make sense?
I would say, well said, is what I would say. It's more than makes sense. That's well said. Yeah.
That makes total sense to me.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the suffering of suffering. And then number two, reject attachments through reflection on the suffering of change. So this is the sticking point for a lot of people, I think, where we say, well, I don't know, looks pretty good to me. But the attachment isn't.
Right.
Because when it changes, the relationship ends, the new car gets a scratch on it, the ice cream cone is no longer ice cream, and it's over, then the happiness isn't quite what it was. And if I said, yeah, but I really want that relationship to continue, I really don't want to have my new car scratched, or I really, it's the attachment that leads us into trouble.
Well, you're looking for another relationship. You want a different flavor of ice cream cone. You're always looking for something that's going to give you that momentary happiness.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So we need to reject the attachment through, there it is again, Aaron, reflection. Yeah? You're going to hear this for weeks and weeks. I can just get used to it. And then third, meditate longingly for liberation through reflection on the suffering of conditioned existence, sometimes referred to as all-pervasive suffering. So meditate on longingly for liberation, liberation meaning to get out of samsara, get out of this vicious circle, you know, through reflection on the suffering of conditioned existence. And that is an overview of what we're now going to dive into here in great depth and detail, which is all these kinds of suffering and why we want to focus on it to develop
compassion, renunciation.
That's the whole point, renunciation, okay? Because you're going to hear some pretty rough stuff here in the next few pages. And you need to keep that in mind. It's for renunciation.
Okay.
You're forewarned. Nicole's ready. She's ready to rock. Okay. And here we are back again with Dafa Gyaltsen and another one of his songs. Who'd like to read this song?
First, the suffering of the suffering is the misery of the lower three realms. If that was well considered, one should begin to tremble, for if it befalls one, there would be no way for one to bear it. Yet instead of cultivating the virtue which abandons the cause of suffering, people again and again cultivate the lower realms. I pity them wherever they are.
Okay, so this is another way of looking at these different kinds of suffering. So, in the human realm, we have all these three kinds. But another way to look at it is that the suffering of suffering is the misery of the three lower realms. What are the three lower realms again?
Hell, hungry ghosts, animals.
So this is another way of looking at the suffering of suffering, that that's what they really experience. And then Sakyapandita goes on in the next quote, even though it doesn't say Sakyapandita, it is from Sakyapandita, and it's a reply to one of his students' questions. Who would like to read that?
I'll read it. The suffering of suffering exists in the three lower realms, like blisters arising on top of the wounds of leprosy. How could one possibly endure such pain if one paused to reflect on it? By reflecting on that, one must refrain from unwholesome deeds.
Okay, so when we reflect on that, then we realize, well, it's the negativity and the karmic result of that that causes it, so we want to reflect on that and refrain from that. And we're going to go into a great deal later about what are the negative deeds and what are the positive deeds. So that'll be coming later. To explicate these three lower realms in detail, one must consider the sufferings of the hells, hungry ghosts, and animals. This is my opinion. But having gone through these kinds of teachings before, I've seen that some Westerners have a bit of a reaction sometimes to this topic. Because most of us who are Westerners, most of us have not grown up in a Buddhist culture. Generally speaking, most of us have grown up in a Christian culture for some form or another. Even if we're not necessarily religious, it's in our culture, mostly. Mm-hmm. And that culture has a model of the hell being the punishment because you went against
God.
The God of some sort or another, and that God is therefore going to punish you.
Right.
Which is not really very happy. And some people have a reaction to that. Maybe they grew up with a strong church-going family like I did, and so they just say, well, I'm not buying that. And there's a kind of rejection of it. But this Buddhist point of view is slightly different than that. Actually, it's quite a bit different than that. In that we don't have a creator God up there that's punishing us because we were bad. What do we have that takes us to the hell realms instead?
Our karma.
Karma. And who creates that?
We do.
We do. It's not out there, it's us.
And the hell realms are a state of mind.
Also.
They're not an actual place.
Now this is a debate. We can debate this if you want. And I'm going to have to be Lama's voice on this. I'm not sure we want to go down that road right now, though. But there is a debate about is it an actual place or not. You're right, it's a state of mind. And anybody that's had a hellish experience in life knows that you can have hell in this life, too. Mm-hmm. So that's true. But the point being here that if you're one of those people that just says, no, this is nonsense because of my upbringing, I've seen people reject this teaching on that basis, and that's It's unfortunate because it's really a misinterpretation of what's being said here. Mm-hmm. There is nobody out there that's punishing you by sending you to hell. Okay, that's my little personal opinion. I'm just throwing that out there. Okay. So we are now going to go through lots of descriptions of all kinds of hells. In Buddhism, there's more than one. So try to keep that in mind, if you can, while we go through this, that nobody's causing this to you. Okay? And then after that, we're going to go through the other two lower realms. So there's going to be, you know, I used to live in Italy, and every school kid in Italy studies Dante's Inferno. Mm-hmm. You know, that classic piece. Maybe you studied it in school, too. Mm-hmm. So this is not Dante's Inferno, although that's a masterpiece. But this is going to be very, very descriptive if you haven't had these teachings before. So here we go. The sufferings of the hells. Who wants to take us?
I'll take it.
Okay.
The suffering of the hells. One should reflect upon, one, the suffering of the cold hells, two, the hot hells, and three, the neighboring and minor hells. One, the eight cold hells are A, the blister hell, B, the bursting blister hell, C, the burr hell, D, the alas hell, E, the chattering teeth hell, F, what is that?
Utpala
flower hell, G, the crack like a lotus hell, and H, the greatly cracked like a lotus hell. A, the blistering hell. One is born in a place wholly encircled by ranges of snow peaks. On a vast frozen plain, one is tormented by the sharp blows of unbearable blizzards. Not even the glimmer of a star can be seen, nor has one even a shred of cloth from which to derive warmth or to rest upon. The beings who inhabit this hell have taken birth here as a result of the ripening of their own former deeds. Instantaneously and miraculously, one is born endowed with a full-sized body and in isolation, due to the coldness, and countless clusters of blizzards arise on one's body.
Blisters, thank you.
Yeah. So generally speaking, the karma, that the action that produces rebirth in hell is anger, although there are some other explanations about other factors, but generally it's anger. Okay, so these are the cold hells. We'll get to the hot hells later. Somebody else want to continue reading?
I'll take a turn.
Okay.
B, the bursting blister hell. Here the chill is 20 times greater than before, and it causes blisters to burst open. Blood and watery fluid flow out of these and freeze. One more?
Yeah, just keep going.
Sure. C, the burr hell. Because of the intense cold, one makes the sound of brr.
Sorry, I don't... Sorry.
Hmm? You have a question?
No, I just thought it was funny.
Oh.
D, the alas hell. The cold is greater still, and one pitifully cries, alas. E, the chattering teeth hell. It being colder still, due to its touch, one's body becomes stiff and one's teeth chatter. F, the Utpala flower hell. Being more intense than the previous hell, the cold causes the skin of one's body to turn blue and crack. G, the cracked like a lotus hell. Now one's skin itself is carried away by a dragging blizzard, and one's body turns red like raw meat. Then, too, it begins to crack into bits and pieces. H, the greatly cracked like a lotus hell. After going through the same experience as before, one's body cracks into hundreds and thousands of pieces. Then one's internal organs spill out, and they also crack.
Okay, so then there's a scriptural quote from Chandragoman. Chandragoman lived in the 7th century, great Buddhist master. Somebody want to read what Chandragoman had to say? Steve, you want to read that?
Okay. Moreover, in these hells, a wind, fierce beyond example, stabs to the bone and carries away the quivering flesh of one's entire body. And one lies there ready to die. Being sprang forth from hundreds of bursting blisters to torment oneself with weapons as marrow, blood, and water start to flow.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, isn't it like, it sounds like a quick life.
Quick life?
Yeah, like if you're dying immediately as soon as you get there in the worst of hells, it's like, well, I mean...
But it keeps going on.
Oh, really?
It happens again and it happens again.
The very next section is about the length of time.
Oh, I see.
You want to read that?
Sure.
You anticipated it.
The length of one's lifetime in these places is described in the... Dozod?
That's the Treasury of Knowledge by Vasubandhu. The Treasury of Insight.
Okay, one second. The length of time exhausted in emptying a barrel of sesame by removing a single seed once a century will equal the lifespan in the blister hell. It is 20-fold longer progressively in each of the others.
So each of these hells is 20 times longer than the one before.
Eons of time.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to get an example of what that looks like in terms of time. Do you want to keep reading there?
Yeah. A barrel of sesame is a vessel which contains 80 kals of... Were you going
to
say something?
A kal is 40 kilograms.
Of large bravo seed used in the kingdom of Magadha. If one were to empty this vessel of sesame by removing a single seed once every 100 human years, the time required will equal the span of a lifetime in the blister hell.
Okay. So a kal is 40 kilograms. If you remove a single seed once every 100 years...
Human years, yeah.
Yeah. The time required will equal the span of a lifetime in a blister hell. In other words, it's a really long time. Okay. But it doesn't finish there. Keep reading.
The life spent in each of the seven lower hells is 20 times progressively longer than that of the one just above it. Thus, the bursting blister hells equals 20 barrels. The burr hell equals 400 barrels. The alas hell, 8,000. The Shattering Teeth Hell, 160,000. The Upala Flower Hell, 3,200,000. The Crack-Like Lotus Hell, 64 million. And the Greatly Crack-Like Lotus Hell, 1,280,000,000 barrels. This estimate of the length of their lifespan is only approximate. If calculated accurately, they would be longer for one sutra states. For example, monks, if someone were to remove a single sesame seed once every 100 years from a heaping Magadha sesame barrel containing 80 kals, the length of time required to empty those 80 kals of sesame would still be relatively quick. For I do not say that the lifespan of beings born in the blister hell will come to an end so speedily.
And then the next paragraph?
Just as the lifespan in the bursting blister hell is 20 times longer than that in the blister hell, so it gets progressively greater up to the greatly cracked, like a lotus hell.
Okay.
So,
it's a long time.
Yeah. Okay.
Really long time. Okay. So that's a little trip through the cold hells. So what do we do with that? Aaron, what should we do with this now? We've listened to it. Yeah, so you want to read the next section?
Sure. The manner in which to reflect upon the meaning of this teaching is as follows. After reciting the refuge formula and the prayer for the blessing of the three jewels, one should sincerely reflect in the following way. Throughout countless eons, alas, right up to the present time, I have been tossed about and distressed by innumerable floods of suffering as a result of my wandering in these places of worldly existence. Having only experienced these many sorrows in the past, it would be truly wonderful if I might no longer be afflicted by them whatsoever. However, until this machine of subject-object dichotomy is destroyed, I shall continue to be led on helplessly into the six realms of existence, and shall have to experience those countless feelings of pain. Then what shall I do? Among those sufferings, what if I were to be reborn tomorrow morning in the cold hells, where the place, conditions, and lifespan are such as explained above?
Okay, so this gives you kind of an outline of what you can analyze and contemplate in the second step. Okay, it actually gives you a text, like a script. It's kind of doing the work for you in a way. You read, we listen, we heard what the hell realms are like, and then you go through this contemplation of, gee, if I don't change, this is going to be the next go-around, or it's possible that I could go around here again. And it says, however, until this machine of subject-object dichotomy is destroyed, I shall continue to be led on helplessly into the six realms of existence. What does that mean?
Something about non-duality?
Non-duality, yeah. What about it? What's the machine of subject-object dichotomy?
Us and them, me and you.
The I.
Yeah. So this is one of the fundamental teachings. Fundamental teachings of the Buddha, right? Selflessness of self and others and so on, which we will get into later. But there's a hint here that this is a machine. Interesting description of it as a machine. It's like it operates automatically. We don't even have to think about, well, of course I have an I, me, mine, and an ego. Of course. It's just there. We don't even think about it. It's like a machine. And we have to, that's what's keeping us in suffering. So we need to, later on, we'll learn how to turn off the machine, so to speak. The analysis continues. Aaron, you want to continue there?
Sure. Now clearly reflect on those conditions of the cold hells just explained. If now I can hardly bear even the slightest contact with the kinds of cold that occur in the human realm, even for a single day, how could I possibly endure it if those feelings of agony in the cold hells were to befall me? Further, I have no confidence that such suffering will not befall me, since the cause of those sufferings is anger, which arises many times each day. When there is no way I can bear those agonies if they befall me, then what shall I do? No matter what happens, therefore, I must rightly practice the holy teaching, which is the remedy of all suffering.
Okay, well, what about the person who says, well, I never get angry?
They're probably mistaken.
They're not telling the truth.
Huh?
They're not telling the truth.
Not telling the truth? But what if they never get angry this lifetime?
They don't understand the many ways anger can express itself.
But what, just theoretically, what if they never got angry this lifetime? Are they home free?
There's another life following.
Following?
Yeah, either way.
But if they didn't do any anger now, they don't have to worry about the following life.
Oh, you do.
Huh?
You may not worry about it, but you're not going to meet it.
But besides the next life, what is there?
Previous lives.
Previous lives. And who knows all of their previous lives? Raise your hand, please. Do you know for sure that in your previous lives you never got angry? Maybe even really angry. Maybe even really, really angry. Maybe you did something really bad, like kill somebody or something. How do you know that in your previous life, karma hasn't ripened yet, and you might be headed south?
So the karma doesn't always happen immediately on the next life. Like someone could have a very angry lifetime, and then a very non-angry lifetime, and then after that see the consequences of previous anger?
Yeah, it doesn't. You know, we have, because John Lennon wrote Instant Karma, we kind of have that phrase in our mind, Instant Karma, but karma is not always instant by any means. You have endless previous lives, beginningless, which is beyond comprehension. You don't know 5,000 years or 5 million lifetimes ago what you did that hasn't ripened yet, because the causes and the conditions didn't come together yet. So there's no guarantee that you're necessarily going forward. You might be going down, right?
And I've also heard teachings where it said that we've been through all of these hell realms, and we've been through it all before at least once. So we've all experienced it in our previous lives.
If you've been through it, that karma is expired. You might have unexpired karma that is still coming.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just that we have experienced all this stuff through past lives.
Okay, so let's continue. Who was reading? I lost track.
Aaron,
you're on again. So we're in the analytical process here, okay?
Thus think from the depths of one's heart. Furthermore, one should think. The teaching to be practiced must not be mere artifice, but should be attuned to the teaching of the conquerors and derived from an uninterrupted lineage of transmission. Especially now, I shall definitely experience the practice of these instructions of the path, including its result, the precious words of the Lamdre. May the preceptors and precious gems see to it that this happens.
Okay, so now we're drawing this analysis to a conclusion, to an end, and we're telling ourselves, because we're doing this is our homework, right? It's to be practiced, it must not be mere artifice, but should be attuned to the teachings of the conquerors. So it can't be something just sort of, you know, la-di-da. But we need to follow the Buddhas who taught, who did the path, and are now teaching us. And it needs to be derived from an uninterrupted lineage of transmission. Remember we talked about lineages and transmissions and that? I think that was the first or the second evening. Do you remember that? What did we say about that? Anybody remember? What's the lineage we're studying here?
Sakya.
More specifically?
The Lamdre.
Lamdre. Is that an authentic lineage?
Yes.
Is it time-tested? Have there been many great masters who got enlightened following it? Mm. Yeah. So, this is not just pulled out of the sky, you know, it's something that's got a long, long, long lineage transmission. It's authentic, in other words. It's authentic. We are, again, lucky, fortunate, good karma to be studying it. And especially now, I shall definitely experience the practice of these instructions. Why especially now?
Because you become aware of the dangers of not, of what can happen if you talk.
And?
You only have now.
Precious human universe.
We've got the 18 boxes. I'd be willing to bet that everybody in this room has ticked the 18 boxes. So we have a very, 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 very rare opportunity.
We're right.
And we have a very great lineage. And we don't want to waste it. Because we don't know what our past karma is. And we're going over there, not down there. But only if we do the work, the three steps and the homework. Okay? So this paragraph is the conclusion of your analysis. They're giving it to you. You don't even have to do the homework. You just have to go, okay, and then do it. Read it, and then meditate on it. Yeah?
So could you say this paragraph is the remedy?
Yeah. Yeah. You agree?
Is it part of the remedy?
No, it's the remedy.
The remedy,
it's
really?
It's the remedy, yeah.
Okay.
And then it says the very last sentence. Aaron, can you read the last sentence again, please?
Sure, especially now.
Wasn't that the last sentence?
Sorry. May the preceptors and precious gems see to it that this happens.
So what kind of prayer is that?
Aspiration.
Sorry?
Aspiration.
It's an aspiration. When you see may, probably it's an aspiration. And the aspiration plants a
seed.
It plants a seed.
In our mind.
Yeah, in your mind stream. It's a karmic seed you're planting. You're aspiring, you know, I'm going to drive to Toronto, I'm going to get the map, I'm going to get the GPS, I'm going to do it. It's not wishful, it's yeah, and I'm asking for the help of who?
The guru.
Huh?
The guru?
Sorry?
The help for what? Sorry, I don't...
To see that this happens, the last sentence, may the... Who?
Preceptors.
Preceptors and?
The precious gems,
the three gems. So the fourfold refuge that we've been talking about. So I'm aspiring to do it, and I'm asking for their help. Because this is not easy to do alone. Okay, so the end of it is an aspiration. It's really, really... Not only is it important, it's very clever. It's skillful. You're being given all these, not tricks, but skills, how to do the practice. Remember, we're in the practice section of the teaching now. Yeah? Not only that, let's keep reading. Who wants to read?
I'll read it.
Uh-huh.
If one wishes to practice at length, then offer the three verses of prayers as given earlier in the refuge section.
Okay, that was page 12 and 13, if you want to go back and check that.
On all occasions, one should do as it is said in the Rinchen Brangba.
That's the precious garland by Nagarjuna.
Refrain from alcohol, possess a good livelihood, practice total nonviolence. Offer gifts with devotion. Show reverence to the excellent ones, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and be loving toward the lowly. This, in brief, is religion.
Okay, so if you want to practice at length, you can go back to page 12 and 13 and do those refuge prayers. But whether you do that or not, on all occasions, you should do what Nagarjuna says in the Precious Garland, which are these ways to behave. And not behave, very specific of what you should do and not do. And that's a kind of, as it says, in brief. It's an in brief summary of how to do it, how to behave. Okay. And then there's more. You want to just keep reading there,
sure.
Please?
Yeah. So one should think that one must dwell within a conduct which is in harmony with the doctrine. Since at this time there are boundless benefits by merely producing just the aspiration to practice the holy doctrine, one should dedicate, as before, the roots of virtue, which arise from these meditations, to others. By being endowed with alertness and mindfulness in all activities, one should constantly maintain a strong revulsion toward worldly existence and maintain the conduct which accords with doctrine.
Okay, thank you.
That's such a weird sentence.
Mm.
Just like, to have revulsion towards world existence, like, that's, like, insane.
It's insane from a worldly point of view. From a spiritual point of view, it's skillful.
Okay.
I see it as, like, learning, like, when you're a kid, you're eating nothing but candy, and you love it, and you're like, I'm gonna grow up, and I'm gonna eat candy for dinner, I'm gonna eat candy for breakfast. But then you have to learn to be revulsed by that.
Right.
To save yourself from yourself.
You will be revulsed by, right?
So I see it sort of that way.
I like that. And
one
word, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
So it's essentially being sick of the endless cycle of...
Yeah, it's saying enough suffering, I've had enough. Haven't you suffered enough yet? I have.
Yeah,
oh, look, it's all in my hand. That hurts. That sucker hurts. I've had enough. And not only that, there's this one too.
I'm only 30. Like,
stick around. Don't worry. It gets better. Right? No, but the Buddha said, don't take my word for it. Test it in your condition,
really,
just like buying gold. Don't take my word for it. Didn't he?
Yeah. You think it's better, but it doesn't.
That's what everybody says.
Oh, poor Nicole. She's just...
You're young enough. At your age, you've got a remedy here. You know there's a way out.
It's
think
true.
Of that. Turn it around. That's
yeah.
actually a blessing, right?
No, I
didn't.
Okay. Nicole wants to keep her attachments.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. Keep them. I don't care. Okay. One must dwell within a conduct in harmony with the doctrine, and they've given you very brief guidelines before. Since at this time there are boundless benefits, Nicole, by merely producing just the aspiration to practice. There's that word again. This aspiration is really powerful. Just producing the aspiration produces incredible benefit, and it says so here. And then one should dedicate as before. Again, going back to page 13, there was a section there about dedication. If your cup has a crack in it, you can patch it up by going back to page 13 and reviewing that. Remember we said there's the three steps. There's refuge, the actual practice, and then the dedication, spreading the merit, the positive energy. So if you need to review dedication, you can do that. So one should dedicate as before the roots of virtue which arise from these meditations. So you dedicate to others. So what does that mean, roots of virtue? What are you talking about, roots?
The merits.
Yeah, but why roots?
The actions that you take are roots.
Yeah, but why are they using that word root?
Because it's the foundation.
It supports the rest of the practice.
Yeah.
It starts with the action.
Yeah. So when you have... Let's see how to say this simply. Normally we think of action. Karma means action. We think, oh, it's one for one, tit for tat, you know, eye for an eye. I do this, I get that back. That's kind of, Westerners anyway, I think, kind of think that way, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But actually that isn't the way it works. Lama Zopa says that actually the better way to think about it is it multiplies 100. So if you have an aspirational seed, an apple seed, and you plant it and you get an apple tree, you have the roots, but you get all these apples from it. Presumably, you know, presuming that the causes and conditions, the water, the sun, and all that were good, you get a tremendous multiplication factor. And that's a more accurate way to think about karma. So you hear the roots of virtue, the roots of non-virtue, the roots of karma. Use this word root to give you the idea that there's going to be this tree or this result that's like bigger. And so it's not one for one. It's one for 100 or something.
And that applies
like that
to both positive and negative,
yeah,
actions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the aspiration is the apple seed. Then we do the practice. We cultivate, watering, fertilizing, so on and so forth. And then the fruit. In fact, sometimes this lamdre is translated as the path including the fruit. That's one of the translations that you read sometimes. So the fruit in this case is enlightenment. We're planting the seeds, we're doing the practice, we're weeding, watering, doing the work. And then we get all these apples and we get to share them with everybody. So that's an important part, I think. And then it says, by being endowed with alertness and mindfulness in all activities, one should constantly maintain a strong revulsion towards worldly existence and maintain the conduct which accords with the doctrine.
Sorry, nothing.
You're still unhappy about that?
Well, it's just weird because it's like not my existence. Like I feel like to think of revulsion is too strong of a word. Like I don't, it's,
yeah.
What word would work for?
Like, do you not wake up and get excited and be like, oh God, I'm so excited to be alive? Like it's weird.
No, that's a good thing.
Oh, I'm excited to be alive too.
Right, like, so it's like, how can you live like that?
Because we live in the endless cycle of birth and death.
So to be like revulsed, it's just like,
well, you could
I don't know.
We have
you
to really dislike
for
it
today.
Right, but how can you experience that? I don't understand.
you're being, the revulsion is for the suffering.
Okay, so
mm-hmm,
it's
not
for your.
No, it's for the suffering.
Okay.
Do you want to suffer?
I do suffer. It's
no,
like,
but do you want it?
To.
Do you want? I really want to suffer today. I hope I get a headache and a backache. And...
No.
No, of course not. Nobody wants to suffer. The revulsion is for the suffering. We get confused about what is suffering and what isn't sometimes.
That's right.
But we don't want to suffer.
Yeah.
So the revulsion is for the cyclic existence that makes us suffer round and round and round and round.
It's weird because I also think that, like, in order to be happy, you kind of have to suffer. It's like you can't separate them both. You can't separate them because you can't tell one from the other if you don't know the opposite. Like,
see, but that's what we've been taught. That's one of the delusions we've been taught.
Really?
That we think. That's a delusion. So that's what this is trying to dispel. The Dharma is trying to dispel that.
This is intense.
There's another point to make is that there's different kinds of happiness. There's temporary happiness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying don't enjoy the flowers. I don't think anybody's saying that.
Yeah, enjoy them.
But if you smell the flower and a bee comes out and stings your nose, that's suffering. And it's the suffering we want to get revulsed. Is that the right word? Revulsed?
Yeah, revulsed, yeah.
Revolted. But also we can enjoy the flowers, but we know that winter's going to come and they're going to die and we're sad because we won't have the flowers anymore, right? So it's sort of that.
It's like setting your mind up to towards the negative aspect of existence. Like, that's what I'm interpreting.
We are deluded, period. If you're not, you would be enlightened if you weren't deluded. The Buddha's not deluded. We have misconceptions all over the place. I mean, it's just endless.
That's true. Of course.
And one of the misconceptions is that, oh, life is pretty good, and this isn't so bad. And, you know, I got a new job, and I'm making better money, and I'm going to buy a new car. And we get caught up in this materialistic or whatever your delusion is, whatever your attachment is, you know.
The culture, yeah.
Huh?
We get caught up in the culture.
The attachment is what we get caught up in.
Maybe we should talk about what attachment means in Buddhism, because I think that's where some of the confusion might be. But attachment is where we over-exaggerate the good qualities of something that is making us happy. And we think it will last forever. That's what attachment is. So we grasp onto it. Because this will make me happy. If I just get that, it will make me happy. I find the perfect relationship, I'll finally be happy. And then when we find those things, we hang on to them for dear life because we think they're making us happy, and if we don't have them, we're not going to be happy. That's grasping. That's an attachment. Not like a mother is attached to her child. Of course they have to be attached in order for the child to thrive and live. So it's not that form of attachment. It's over-exaggerating the goodness of something and how it's going to make you happy. You will finally be happy. That's what the attachment means. Is that kind of clear?
Mm-hmm. If I was, like, relating it to what you said about waking up and being excited, like, to be alive and excited for the day, I think someone with an unhealthy attachment, like, to take it to an extreme, would probably be really excited. It's the morning, it's sun's up, I'm going to go do all this stuff. But then they would, like, despair when the sun went down. Not because they're not alive, but because that thing that brought them happiness was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of cycle of happiness comes, happiness goes, happiness comes, happiness goes, it's the process of that that we're supposed to be dissatisfied with, I think, right?
The attachment.
The attachment of those things that make us happy.
Right. You know, not seeing
like
it
a flower
really
can totally
are.
Make us happy, but to think that it's going to make us happy to the end of our life, and then we're going to be reborn, and the same flower is going to be there, and we're still going to be happy, but, like, that's the revulsion part, is that the inevitability of the loss of that flower.
Right.
Can I write?
Yeah.
Which is the suffering of change.
Right.
It will change, and so we suffer because that it changes our state of happiness. Because we're grasping.
Thankfully, you don't have to change your mind today.
But don't take our word for
I'm
it.
I'm not. I'm not taking your word for anything.
But if you do your homework. Okay. Yeah, this is a big step. I mean, I can remember struggling for a long time with this one. So anyway, let's wrap this up by saying, let's see, where are we? So it's the alertness and the mindfulness of what's really going on. Normally we don't necessarily do that all the time. So we want to do that. Yeah, and that is the end of the cold hells. So I think that's a good place to stop. And to be continued, the trip will continue next class into the hot hells. Any final words, comments anybody wants to make?
I just want to say that some teachers explained that not all attachment is negative.
No.
That the child's attachment to its mother, since this is very functional, and our attachment to the teacher is functional, you know, as long as we keep on an even keel. I mean, there's all these caveats, but one can purify some of the damage from attachment by having attachments that make sense, that work, that are good for you.
But they're still different from the attachment that Buddhism is talking about, I think.
Nonetheless, it's still attachment.
Because you can love your child and have attachment for them, but that attachment at some point in time can become a negative thing when you can't let that child live their life the way they want to. You want to make you want the light to turn out the way you think it should, and then that attachment turns into something that is suffering, right?
Well, yeah. It's not appropriate. There is appropriate attachment and inappropriate attachment.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And the appropriate attachment is always time sensitive.
Yes.
Time when one should let go of the hot potato.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And there's an aspect of mind training that's called pliancy. Mm-hmm. Which is exactly what that is. It's knowing how to use your mind at the appropriate time for the appropriate purposes with the aspiration in mind.
Mm-hmm. I like to check whether I'm appreciating something or whether I'm attaching myself to it. Because that's sort of my distinction of it can bring me happiness and I'm appreciating it, but knowing it's temporary, knowing it's could change, knowing even my outlook towards it could change, like the candy thing.
Yeah.
I love candy. Candy
not only candy, could change, but will change. Definitely will change. Okay.
That's a whole other topic.
Okay, so there's plenty of homework we can digest, if you want, from this. So let's do our dedication. So nam de ni tam che ji pai to na ne be da nam pam je te ke ga na ji ba lung tu pe se pe so le da ro a shu chang chu sem jo rim po che Ma ke panam ke gurchi ke manyam parme paryam gong ne gong tu pel parsho jam pa pa o jitar ken padam kuntu sang po de yang de jinde de da kungi je su da lo Gewa di dagdam che rab tunu Tu su jeg pi gawa nam che ki Nuwa ganga chutu nga pagi Dakshin gewe ca wadi kundrim Sang po chu che rab tunu wargi Chak sawa dang chu ching shak padam Jesu yi rang ku shing so wai Ge wa chung ze da gi chi sak Tan che zo pe jang chu chu
By
this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it ever decline where it has arisen, and may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little merit I may gain from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.